Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Reifert v. South Central. Mr. Barry?
Thank you, Your Honor.
It's Reifert.
Reifert.
It's a name I had to practice pronouncing when I first met the gentleman because it can be pronounced two different ways. I'd like to start by discussing a case, United States v. Brown, that is cited three times by defendants in their brief. And I missed the significance of this case when I first prepared my own briefs. In preparing for today's argument, I noticed some astonishing parallels that I think are worth a few minutes. In United States v. Brown, a Ninth Circuit case from 1991, the criminal convictions of two corporate insiders were affirmed. The facts of the case were that two of the leading billboard companies, Gannett and Foster and Kleiser, had agreed that they wouldn't poach on each other's customers under something called the one-year rule. And under the one-year rule, which is originally written, it went as follows: that if one of them had a billboard site and their lease on that space expired with the owner, that the other one wouldn't go after that space within 1 year after the expiration of that lease, which meant the owner of the space, here's a big building site, big blank wall. Let's say Gannett wants to renew for another period, and the owner says, "I want more money." And Gannett says, "I'm not going to pay that." And the owner says, "Well, fine. You can't have the space."
But of course, Mr. Barry, that's not the multiple listing service facts. What you have in the multiple listing service is effectively a joint venture among all these realtors. It creates a product, not unlike in the ASCAP case, that could not be created if each person was out on his or her own with individual listings. And the period of disability, if you will, ends with the listing. Now, certainly the rule does say you can't approach somebody during the period of a listing and ask for the right to be that new broker, but you can as soon as the listing expires. And so the question is whether, first of all, we ought to apply something like joint venture analysis to this case, and secondly, what are the pro- and anti-competitive consequences of this rule?
ASCAP is exactly the place to start. It is true, you can't have a multiple listing service without some degree of restraints.
Well, that's right, because common sense would tell you, as well as your opponents have pointed out, that you need to make sure that free riding effects aren't there. You need brokers to feel that if they put their listing in, somebody won't poach on their efforts. And so if we're in the world of ASCAP, as the Supreme Court cautioned there, you can't look at fairly simple labels, this is not really the no poaching rule of Brown, in my view, given that that was just flat out, a post-contract one-year term agreement not to compete between competitors. Here we have something much more subtle. And yet I don't see in this record evidence going to the balancing of the pro- and anti-competitive consequences of this MLS venture.
Let's take it from Reifert's point of view. He represents buyers. He's not allowed to approach those listers and say, "I represent buyers, and if you're looking for a house to buy, I'll do a great job." There is no contract with that listing agent giving them the exclusive right to represent that person as a buyer. Now, the brief of opponents denies that's the case, and they cite on page 40 of their brief, they say, Reifert's allowed to approach these people, but that is exactly untrue.
But I looked at the rules, Article 16, I think. I didn't see in the rules prohibitions for different transactions. Now, certainly, if you list a house as a seller with a particular broker, that's it. And I can even see reasons why you would want to wait. Maybe they aren't compelling, maybe they are, but maybe you'd want to wait till the end of that listing so that somebody doesn't come to the seller and say, you've listed your house at $1 million. Why don't you hold out for that last cent because I'm going to give you a better deal the minute that listing ends? I mean, that would be a risk that you'd want to protect against. But I really didn't see in the Article 16 something as strong as you're arguing.
Page 26 of my attachment. That's the standards of practice. They quote that in their brief at page 40, but they omit the following sentence. However, information received through a multiple listing service or any other offer of cooperation may not be used to target clients of other realtors to whom such offers to provide services may be made. Reifert can't use the MLS as a target list. Now, he infringes nobody's contract to send letters saying, I represent buyers.
Well, what does that mean, though? I mean, if it's, I understand that he's a buyer's agent, but I'm not sure that the kind of targeting that's talking about covers somebody with no contract whatsoever about buying.
It does. That's what it says.
Well, I don't know if that's what it says. And even if it does say that, if he's already under some contract, if that other seller, I mean, a lot of people are both sellers and buyers at the same time, right? They list their house, and then they are interested in buying some other house. Well, they're not under contract with anybody vis-a-vis the second house.
Exactly. They're allowed to use as many buyer agents as they want. They can say, bring me houses for sale. I would love to buy them. And whoever brings me the best house is the one I'm going to buy.
Sure.
And it says right here, you cannot use that to target people. Reifert wants to find buyers, and obviously the time when that buyer is most interested in finding an agent is when they're in the transaction themselves. A rule which says you cannot approach anybody until they're out of contract says you can't focus on the folks when they're most interested in dealing with you.
So you think that if somebody's under a contract with Agent A to sell their house, that Mr. Reifert can't go and say, I want a completely different contract with you. I don't want to sell your house. I never want to sell your house.
I want to help you buy a house. Anywhere in the United States, he can help them in the...
But they're entitled to do that by themselves. Sit there and cruise through the Internet or otherwise.
Well, of course, but why should Reifert have to agree to a rule that bars him from that to get his MLS? That's the time.
Well, but
here,
my point is they couldn't just sell their house by themselves because they're under contract with somebody.
Right. If they find their own buyer under the terms of these contracts, they'll owe
a
commission to the agent. That's right.
I know.
That's right. But there's no restraint on their ability to look around with one or more agents. They're not tied to that listing broker when it comes to their purchase.
A completely different transaction.
Exactly right.
For all we know, they don't even want to buy another house. Maybe they want to move into some place and rent, you know, or whatever.
And he might want to represent them on that. And he still can't do it. He can't touch that, the most interested pool of people there is. The folks who are moving out of one place are probably going to live somewhere else, either buy or rent. He cannot touch that group until after that listing expires. And there's now a much greater likelihood they've already completed their buy transaction. It's so common, of course, you buy one place conditioned on sale of the previous place.
Now, how does this relate to the theories you presented to the district court? We aren't discussing at the moment anything about tying arrangements or group boycotts. We're talking about something else.
Well, this was presented to the district court. We're saying there's a tie-in here.
Well, but you agree this is not – what you and I have been talking about is not anything about a tying arrangement or a group boycott. We've been talking about – this joint venture, MLS, somehow exercising its market power vis-a-vis Mr. Reifert, saying you have to be a member. In fact, it's a compelled membership. It's the opposite of a boycott.
Well, no. We're not going to sell you our product. We refuse collectively to sell you our product unless you go along with our rules. That's a boycott. To mitigate his damages,
well,
he paid the fee.
Well, it's not necessarily a boycott, actually.
It's implicit. We will – well, yes, it's the flip side of a boycott. The purpose of a horizontal boycott is you will conform to the way we believe you should do business or we're not going to sell you our product. We will refuse to do business with you if you don't do it our way. And so Reifert has done it their way. He's paid the fees unhappily. He's conformed to the rules unhappily, and that's why we're here today. He wants to exercise all the rights the state of Wisconsin gave him to compete. This is lawful conduct in Wisconsin under the state law of Wisconsin.
Well, I mean, but...
What he wants to do.
What the MLS may be doing may also be lawful conduct.
Why do they? But they have taken away his right to compete under Wisconsin law.
People now, take away rights to compete all the time when there are contracts. The ASCAP people, you know, you couldn't go use a portion of the ASCAP library without paying the blanket license too. And maybe some of those copyright holders would have had no objection to that.
Well,
you had to pay the blanket license.
Let me answer the earlier question. What's the relationship to tie-in? The fact is this. One of the things we're required to prove in tie-ins is that there's a harm to competition. The harm to competition is every buyer in the Madison area is deprived of buyer agents being able to say, hey, I can do a better job finding homes than anybody else. Please consult with me.
Well, but where's the harm in the tied product market? If you're going to go the tying route, you have to have, you know, okay, we'll say the tying product is the MLS service, which is unique enough that there'd be market power. Where's the harm in the tied product market?
The tied product market, of course, is the national market for trade association services, and that includes trade associations like NABA.
But your opponents say it also, I mean, if it's trade association services, you mean something much more specific than that, of course, because you are not including the American Medical Association. You aren't including, you know, the Car Dealers Association of America or what have you. You're
That's
talking
correct.
About a much more specific
yes.
set of trade associations.
Of course. And that is under the Beatrice factors, the American Medical Association would not be in the same product market. We say that license is the thing that is one of the reasons it's narrowed down to real estate brokers on one hand or real estate appraisers on the other.
What you're saying is you allege that there is a tied product market of associations of licensed real estate brokers? I
yes.
mean, you've never really defined this terribly clearly,
I
don't think.
Well, in our brief, we certainly did. The license granted by the state defines the market, which is there's two different markets here. One is trade association, one is real estate agents, and one is appraisers. Two different licenses, and there's two different sets of trade associations. NAR happens to market to both. And so does the National Association of Real Estate Brokers. NAREB accepts as members appraisers. Their products are identical.
And what is your evidence at the summary judgment stage that there is any kind of impact in a tied product market for trade associations that cater to people who hold real estate licenses?
We showed that four trade associations have diminished sales rates in markets that are what we call closed.
The open-closed market. But isn't that the evidence that the trial court thought you submitted too late, Mr. Riddle's supplemental statement?
That was opinion evidence. We also submitted the count of the numbers by Armitage. Did a count of probably over 50 trade associations, some open, some closed. Most were closed, some were open. And it showed four with very large differences in sales rates.
Did you have any testimony from anyone in these associations saying, we think we're losing members because NAR has the rules that it has?
No.
Okay.
Nor do I believe I need that. And indeed, that kind of testimony is itself subject to huge evidentiary attacks. That declaration was presented in Thompson. And the 11th Circuit commented in a footnote that it was admissible evidence, but as a trial lawyer, my belief is that is very thinly admissible. For a person to say just out of the blue, oh yeah, we'd have a lot more sales if it weren't for this NAR rule.
Well, it certainly is true that you want something. I mean, maybe if it's the membership director and he recalls people calling him up and saying, I'm dropping my membership or I'm not going to join you because you're too expensive, whatever, I can imagine evidence. There were issues on the other side with your evidence, though, as to why those membership rates might have been different. Was it controlled for differences in various geographic markets?
Defendants had the opportunity to show that by applying new controls, the difference would disappear, but they didn't do that. The evidence we put in was admissible, was sufficient for a finder of fact to determine that there was an adverse effect. What's more, the very effect I mentioned in my opening, that is NABA itself, all its members are impacting these closed markets by saying none of them anywhere in the United States can target people who are in the MLS who want to receive buyer services. It makes it harder for an agent to be a buyer's agent operating under those limits. So the very ability to compete for membership is limited by the ability for those people to survive as brokers, just as Reifert does. That is the impact on that trade association. It's impaired by the rules in effect throughout the United States. On the issue of market definition, the reason we're here is the court believed that the trade associations we offered were limited in scope. They had interests in racial, ethnic, or practice areas of the real estate market. Thompson, of course, had that very same division.
Right, but the difference with Thompson is what we were just talking about, that there were these 400 people, supposedly, who said, you know, I can't do both, and so the impact on that membership was...
I would find it difficult. Let's just hypothetically say that Narub, whose deposition we took, who was not asked the question, but even if he'd said, oh, yeah, we'd have more members, I can imagine a very difficult time defending that bald assertion here in this court. How does he know? Has he ever done a study? Has he ever done a count? Isn't that hearsay upon hearsay? There are a lot of layers of difficulty with that. The Thompson court allowed it, but I believe there is much stronger evidence that could be presented. I believe statistical evidence is far stronger. We've shown wide variations in sales rates. Defendants say, oh, you've got to have a statistician for that. But differences this gross do not require statistical support. I see my white light is on, so I'll reserve the balance. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Barry. Eric?
Good morning, Your Honors. Until I listened to Mr. Barry's argument, I thought that this case concerned the membership rule of defendant South Central Wisconsin Multiple Listing Service, the wholly owned subsidiary of defendant Realtors Association of South Central Wisconsin. Under the membership rule, a real estate broker or agent who wants to join the MLS must be a member of an association of realtors. Notably, they need not join the Realtors Association of South Central Wisconsin. They may join whatever association of realtors they wish. Now, the membership rule serves two important purposes. First, it assures that each participant in the MLS adheres to the Realtors Code of Ethics. This assurance is important to the success of the MLS because it means that brokers and agents know that if they place their listings in the MLS, and thus expose those listings to all of their competitors, their clients will not be solicited by others during the term of the listing agreement for that property.
Mr. Beerig, just to clarify the one point that we were discussing with Mr. Barry, he reads the rule that he read to us as precluding targeting somebody who has listed a house for sale from using Mr. Reifert's service for a completely different transaction, looking around for a house to buy. Is that the way you read that rule?
No, that is completely not the way we read the rule. And in fact, as we cite in our brief, if Your Honors read Standard of Practice 16.3, it says Article 16 does not preclude realtors from contacting the client of another broker for the purpose of offering to provide or entering into a contract to provide a different type of real estate service, or from offering the same type of service for property not subject to other brokers' exclusive arrangements.
So what would be the case? I mean, that's the language I was thinking of when I was asking Mr. Barry about that. Suppose Smith has a listing, you know, with Agent A in the MLS because Smith wants to sell his house, and now Mr. Reifert wants to help him find a house to buy. And I guess the question is, can he somehow contact the people who have listed other houses? You know, Jones has a house that's listed with another agent to buy, is that, or to sell his house. So there's another contract on that house, although they're all sales contracts. How does this work?
Well, I see nothing in Article 16 that would prevent Mr. Reifert from contacting Smith to say, if you're thinking about buying another house, I'd like to be your buyer's agent for that one. I don't see anything in Article 16.
And there's no evidence in the record to suggest that the ethics rule has ever been interpreted this way?
None that I am aware of. Okay. None that I am aware of. The purpose of this provision is precisely what Your Honor said. It's to assure a broker that when he or she puts a listing in the MLS, that the competitors will not try to take that listing from the person who has listed it. The purpose of the MLS is not to sort of make the listing fair game for every other broker who has access. It's to allow other brokers to find a buyer who is willing to purchase the property. And that's, in essence, the purpose of Article 16.
Now, the Supreme Court has a joint venture case before it right now. Is there anything in that Texaco case that you think would bear on this, or are you essentially offering us joint venture analysis for the MLS?
Well, we would be offering the joint venture analysis in the ASCAP case that you mentioned if that were the issue in the case. You would think that if Article 16 were really at issue in the case, NAR, whose article it is, would be the defendant in the case. You would think that would have been addressed by Judge Shabazz. You'd think it would have been mentioned in the complaint. But none of those things are true. I think what happened is Mr. Berry read Judge Shabazz's opinion and figured he'd better develop a new theory. So if Article 16 were at issue, we would be relying on ASCAP and the analysis that Your Honor has provided. But as I said, NAR is not a defendant. It wasn't raised in the complaint. It was not addressed by Judge Shabazz. So, we don't think we get there. But I offer this only to give the court an understanding that the membership rule, which is at issue in this case, serves very pro-competitive and understandable purposes. It also, just moving on from Article 16, another article of the code guarantees that each participant in the MLS has agreed to arbitrate in a very efficient, inexpensive manner disputes among MLS participants, which is very important to induce people to participate in this enormously pro-competitive entity, the MLS.
Mr. Berry, you provided supplemental authority, the district court case from Kentucky, which you and Mr. Berry were involved, I guess.
Right.
How many of these cases are there around the country?
As far as I know, there are three. There's one in Kentucky where the court found, much like Judge Shabazz, that there is no competition in the market for the Tide product, and in addition found that there was no antitrust injury alleged by the plaintiff. That case is going up to the Sixth Circuit. There is another case pending in the Eastern District of Washington in Spokane called the Principe case, I believe, but we were not fortunate enough to have been hired in that case, so Mr. Berry has other adversaries in that one. Okay, there was a fourth one, but the plaintiff passed away. So those are the only three. The second important purpose of the membership rule is that it provides an efficient mechanism for allocating the costs of realtor association services that underlie the smooth functioning of the MLS. And those costs include the maintaining and enforcing of the code of ethics, administering the arbitration system, and educating real estate licensees on matters that enable them to work effectively with one another in the brokerage of real property.
Now, I wonder if we could talk for just a minute about the evidence that Mr. Berry wants us to look at about the difference between open and closed jurisdictions, because I'm a little bit unclear about the extent to which this comes in the record in the testimony of Mr. Riddle, or the affidavit, whatever, of Mr. Riddle, that the district court said came too late, and how much it's in the record already. And also, it is a little interesting from an antitrust point of view that there are areas where there is somehow a more open system.
Well, he uses the word open or closed. I mean, that's just the word open versus closed is a phrase to whether there is a membership rule in that area.
Right.
But as Judge Shabazz found, the study was submitted too late, and therefore under Rule 37 it was barred. But beyond that, it is methodologically extremely flawed. He's comparing different parts of the country without in any way accounting for variables in those parts of the country. So you have to look, and we submitted in the briefs the analyses of our statistical experts who explain why the failure to control for those variables makes his studies unreliable. Certainly
so,
unreliable.
So your position at a minimum would be that this was not unrebutted on your part?
Not unrebutted at all. It was unreliable, and certainly not the kind of reliable evidence that this court looked for in the Menasha case, where it required sound econometric evidence. But beyond that, here's the key point. Not even Mr. Riddle, the author of the study, viewed those studies as probative of the issue as to whether there's competition between these niche organizations, as Mr. Berry asserts, and realtor associations. He was directly asked that in his deposition. He said, no, that's not the purpose of this study at all. So what the antitrust laws require is that there be some adverse effect on competition in the Tide product market. There can't be an adverse impact on competition if there are no competitors in the Tide product market. And Mr. Riddle was directly asked, do you regard your study as going to the issue of whether there is competition between these niche organizations and realtor associations? And he said, no, that's not the purpose of this study.
Well, apparently he had not been asked that question, I guess, until the last minute, or if he was asked the question.
He was asked the question in his deposition,
yeah.
And we've cited that.
So these niche organizations, just to be clear, are not things that would count as an association of realtors, such as such that they could participate in the MLS.
That is correct, because they don't require adherence to the Realtor Code of Ethics. They don't offer the arbitration things. They are not part of the Realtor Association family, which does these other things, which support the MLS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, and the notion, for example, that an association of exclusive buyer's agents is in the same market as a realtor association would be like saying that a limited patent bar is in the same product market as the Chicago Bar Association. I mean, that doesn't seem intuitively correct, and you would certainly want to see some kind of cross-elasticity study or some kind of econometric evidence that would support that. And we have absolutely none in this case. Okay? And I want to make a point that Your Honor made that I think is worth extreme underscoring, which is the best case for Mr. Barry is the Thompson case. But in the Thompson case, there is direct, clear evidence that 400 real estate brokers and agents either declined to join or quit the Empire board because they had to pay dues to a realtor association in order to get access, and therefore there was this adverse effect on competition. There is zero evidence to that effect. In fact, the only evidence there is with respect to Mr. Reifert himself. Mr. Reifert testified that the only other organization, only one of these niche organizations that he wanted to join was NABA, the National Association of Exclusive Buyers Agents, and he joined that. And he was asked, well, did your membership in a realtor association have any impact on your ability to or your willingness to join NABA? And he testified, no.
No, I mean, he did pay more. I mean, I guess he doesn't like paying the Realtor Association. Right?
Well, that's what it comes down to. He doesn't like paying the Realtor Association, but that's not what the antitrust laws are about. The antitrust laws don't protect his desire not to pay the Realtor Association. It protects against adverse effects on competition. And, I want to make another point here. Why are we concerned about adverse effects on competition in the Tide product market, which is really what the antitrust laws care about? It's because we're concerned that the tying arrangement may either result in increased prices or reduced output in the market for the Tide product.
Yeah.
Here, when we strip through all this, there are two reasons that we should recognize such that those concerns ought not to be present here. First of all, as I mentioned, the rule is that a real estate agent or broker can join any association of realtors. So we know that there is competition among associations of realtors.
Which, okay, I take it at this point anyway is what Mr. Barry is saying the Tide product market is. It isn't just associations for professional services, which of course is too big and not pertinent. It's associations of people who are, I'll say, in the real estate business, who don't want to be formal realtors.
Right, that's what he would say. We would not agree with that, as Your Honor knows.
Right.
There certainly is competition among local associations of realtors. In fact, of the roughly, I think, 2,300 members of the MLS in Wisconsin, 331 of them belong to associations of realtors other than the Realtor Association of South Central Wisconsin. So we know that there is competition in this market, and that competition can be relied upon to keep costs down. But there's something even more fundamental, which makes this market different from your typical commercial market, and that is that the price that is paid, i.e. the dues to these associations, and the package of services that is offered by these associations is set by the board of directors that is elected by the members. Okay, so that the price paid and the package of services, the output, is determined by the members themselves. In those circumstances, I don't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
Well, I was going to say, in those circumstances, we have a fair amount of confidence that we're not going to have unduly high price or restricted output because the persons who are setting the price are paying the price, and the persons who are using the output are determining the output. So that makes this somewhat different from your typical commercial situation.
It might, except that the Supreme Court has never gone all the way down the path of saying that nonprofits get different treatment under the antitrust laws. I mean, to the contrary, you see NCAA with Justice White saying in the educational field there really should be a different rule, and the court says no, you know, it's the same rule. And I think what it's worried about is that there is a slight difference between those who make the rules and those who follow them, and maybe they're even ordering up too many services. There are various competitive harms that can exist.
First of all, I think the Supreme Court has said that you have to look at the specifics of what's before you. If you're dealing with a profession or a nonprofit, you can't necessarily apply the rules quite the same. In fact, I would cite to Your Honor footnote 17 in the Goldfarb decision, mm-hmm. where you will see that. But beyond that, the courts have frequently looked at the fact that they were dealing with a nonprofit and said, we have to apply these rules with some understanding of the differences between nonprofits and for-profits. Not that nonprofits are exempt or that they get a free pass because of their nonprofit status,
right.
But we have to look at the particular differences in applying these general rules. And what we see here is not that it's nonprofit. That's not what I'm relying on. I'm relying on the fact that if we're concerned about higher prices or reduced output in the tied product market, we need have much less concern where those who are setting the price are paying the price and where those who are getting the output are determining what the output is. We shouldn't have that fear, particularly since, as I said, under the rule, under the membership rule, you don't have to just join the Realtors Association of South Central Wisconsin. You can join any Realtors Association, which suggests that competition among Realtors Association will keep prices down. And that also, by the way, is yet another distinction from the Thompson case, in which Mr. Thompson had to join the Atlanta board. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't competition among the associations of Realtors in Georgia at that time.
Mr. Okay. Berry, do you think there's still a per se rule against tying arrangements?
I think there, in some cases, there is some lip service paid to that. But I think this court has recognized, and review of the cases would strongly suggest, that there is not a per se rule. Because the cases that talk about per se, they say it's per se if four or five different criteria are met, and then those criteria are, in effect, the rule of reason. Clearly, as I said, Your Honor, what tying law is designed to do is to make sure that someone cannot use his or her power in the market for the tying product to skew competition in the market for the tied product. So what the courts have done, even though they sometimes pay lip service to that per se thing, they're really making determinations as to whether there's a concern about increase or decrease in competition leading to an increase in price or a reduction in output in the tied product market, which we just don't see here at all. So although I think there's some loose language in some cases, I don't think anyone for a moment believes that there should be a per se rule. And in fact, Justice O'Connor, in her concurring opinion
in Hyde, yeah.
Yeah, basically says it quite correctly, I think.
In the D.C. Circuit, jettisoned it in Microsoft, although that's obviously a different kind of market.
And this court, in one of the cases cited in our brief, I think it's the A.O. Smith case, sort of strongly says, you know, this is a very funny kind of per se rule. This is very different from other per se cases. This is also, we've talked a lot about time. Maybe I should briefly mention something about his notion of boycott. This is a very funny kind of boycott, Your Honor. Very, very funny kind of boycott in the sense that we are not in any way trying to boycott Mr. Reifert or anyone else. We're urging him to join. So the notion that this is a boycott is, to me, pretty bizarre. The I think on the boycott point, let me also say that this case is, well, let me talk about what the Supreme Court of New Jersey said in Pomanowski. It said, where there are no exclusionary conditions attached to the realtor board membership, and there is no contention that the cost is prohibitively high, it is difficult to see any affront to competition. Okay, that is exactly what this case is. There are no exclusionary conditions whatever attached to realtor board membership, and there is no contention that the cost is prohibitively high. In fact, it was $441. And that is yet, I think, another distinction from the Thompson case, because in Thompson, you have this history of racial discrimination at the Atlanta board that I think the court viewed as an exclusionary condition, even though it wasn't a formal exclusionary condition. Mm-hmm. I think the court said to itself, the fact of this history of racial discrimination is like an exclusionary condition. We don't have that here. And as Judge Shabazz said, for all the reasons that this case doesn't make out a claim for a tie, it also does not make out a claim for an unlawful group boycott. I see that my time is up, but if the court has any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Berry. Mr. Berry.
Let me quickly cover some of the matters that we just heard discussed. Number one, ASCAP. Court rejected a per se label on that just because it could, in theory, be argued to be price fixing. The Supreme Court sent it back down to the Second Circuit to evaluate under a rule of reason standard. The court found, as a matter of law, based on the 6-week trial, the record was full enough to show them that it was reasonable as a matter of law, because basically you can't do blanket licensing any other way. In contrast here, we've shown MLSs all over the United States that operate without a realtor requirement. Number two, the per se standard in this circuit. This circuit has expressed a concern about the per se standard for tie-ins. And Partson Lecture, the court, told us they want to see that there's some danger that the malfeasor has some danger of overtaking the market in the tied product. In this case, we have a 90% market share. The questions that the court has raised about the impact of the tied product market are quite separate about what the definition of that tied product market is. The tied product market should clearly include these other associations. Their products are identical.
Mr. Berry, do you want to respond at all to Mr. Berry's comments about Article 16?
Yes.
It seems so diametrically opposed.
Yes, they are diametrically opposed. One of the witnesses was Niersbach. He was an employee, a 30-year employee of the National Association of Realtors. I thought I asked him that exact question. I haven't memorized that. All through this case, it's been clear to me that Article 16 prohibits the conduct that Reifert wants to do, which is use the MLS to solicit buyer customers. The quotation that Your Honor recalls that Mr. Beard quoted, the two sentences occur together. I read the omitted sentence, and the sentence I read begins with, however. It says, sure, you can approach customers about a new product. However, you can't use the MLS as your source. As a matter of construction of a contract, it is absolutely clear that buyer agents cannot use this to target buyers. Niersbach, I asked the court to study that deposition. If the court wants, I can go back and send a letter to the court after conferring with Mr. Bierig. I know I asked Niersbach, would the sky fall in if buyer agents were allowed to contact buyers who were listed in the MLS? And Niersbach said, I can't think of a single bad thing that would happen. That answers the ASCAP issue. Bad things would happen if you didn't have a blanket license, one price, for everything from Frank Sinatra to Frank Zappa. That's the only way you can do a blanket license. It was unrebutted. The expert for the sequence quoted to Your Honors was not presented correctly. He was asked about the deposition testimony of Riddle. That was before he'd done his second study. He was not asked to do the second study based on new data until after the time under the rules. So it was the second opinion that was barred, but the data was in the record. The data about
the differential
sales. And so instead of 400 lost sales in Georgia, we have thousands of lost sales.
But the data doesn't explain why these markets are different. I mean, you know, you would have to do a controlled study to see what's the effect of the rule versus what's the effect of, you know, the economy in Las Vegas or whatever, you know, that other part of the country.
Well, the economy would affect everyone equally. If everyone's got lots of money, everyone's going to join trades.
No, their economy in some parts of the country sometimes is doing well, and in other parts it's more depressed.
But it would affect trade associations selling that market equally. There's no advantage of one trade association over another. We're saying that these little associations have a disadvantage in those markets compared to NAR. Their sales are down. I believe that goes to weight non-admissibility. My time's up. Thank you very much.
All right. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the second.